We look at mortality indicators in white America and what they say about the U.S. more broadly here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Princeton University's Anne Case, along with her spouse, started to research life expectancy 8 years ago, thereabouts. This was about the time when, for the first time in decades, life expectancy started declining in the wealthiest country in the world. And now, as other high-income countries rebound from the pandemic, life expectancy in the U.S. is expected to decline once again for 2021, according to population scientists looking at that preliminary data. And this is largely driven by deaths among white Americans. So what is causing deaths from drug overdoses, from alcohol poisoning, suicide? Is American capitalism complicit? 800-642-1234. Anne Case is Emeritus Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton, co-wrote the book from 2020 called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. And welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you coined this term, deaths of despair, and I'm wondering, can you first acquaint us with what is a death of despair?
Sure. What we found was that among whites, starting in the early 1990s, deaths from suicide, from alcoholic liver disease and cirrhosis, and from drug overdose started to climb. And we bin those together in part because it's hard for a coroner or a medical examiner sometimes to know what the intent was. And in part because it's all deaths by one's own hand. And because we think it all three causes of death show a certain amount of despair, which is not a clinical term, but I think it's a term that resonates with people. And it just became a shorthand for us, for so we didn't have to keep saying alcoholic liver disease and cirrhosis and suicide and drug overdose.
So people experience despair in different ways, and I would imagine it's unique to the individual. So if health researchers, is what I'm hearing, can better understand the contours of despair, the nuances, the warning signs of it, that could lead to better understanding what's happening now. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it, that the mortality rates, which continue to climb for all three causes of death, is only the tip of the iceberg. Underneath that, what we find is that year on year in these large nationally representative surveys, people without a college degree report more and more difficulty socializing with friends. They report more pain, neck pain, lower back pain, and they report poor mental health. And all three of those things, pain and isolation and poor mental health, are correlates of suicide. So the what we call morbidity, which is the lack of good health, correlates really strongly with these deaths. And only among people without a bachelor's degree do we see these things going up and have been going up. For people with a BA, it's almost like a talisman. It seems to protect them against these causes of death.
So your education, like a four-year degree, is almost like a determinant of health?
Well, we don't want to say it's a determinant. Okay. Because we don't think it's a case that you can like pin a BA on someone and then they are protected. Mm-hmm. It's a very long-standing question in health economics. To what extent does education actually cause people to have better health? Or to what extent is education standing in for other things? But in the book, what we argue is that what education seems to do right now in the US is open up good jobs. And that for people with less than a BA, including people who have like an associate's degree, good jobs have disappeared. And we don't see them coming back. And that's two-thirds of adults in the U.S. They're not participating in sort of a great thriving of better health and higher wages and more security for retirement, just the opposite. And we call that the great divide, that it's really, it seems to be the case that as a society, we've broken in two, where there are the haves and the have-nots, and two-thirds, we've decided two-thirds of the American population have not.
I'm wondering, Anne, what about work ethic? There's that argument that people don't have the same work ethic as previous generations, that people now are lazier, that they don't really want the job. What do you make of that argument?
I bristle at that. I think that calling it sort of like a white working class culture, which has lost its industriousness, that doesn't actually stand up when you look at the data, because what the data show is that the high point of blue collar wages in the US was 1972. And there's been a long downward trend in real wages for less educated people since then. Started with men, women with a lag. At the same time, employment has fallen for these people. So when employment falls and wages fall, it's more a signal that the demand for that type of worker has fallen, rather than it being that these workers just refuse to supply their labor.
Talking with Anne Case, Emeritus Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton, has documented over the years a rise in what she calls deaths of despair, particularly among working class white people. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts on this, 800-642-1234. I found it particularly interesting that, you're looking at trends that go back a half century and about economic mobility for middle-aged people with relatively low levels of education. But we're now just seeing, I think, some of these really troubling trends around life expectancy. Do you think that this has been like a long runway to see these dropping life expectancies with economic mobility? What about these two timelines?
So, great question. There are two related things. There are mortality rates, which tells you what is the risk that somebody's going to die. And then there's life expectancy, which is how long on average you would expect a person's going to live. And when these mortality rates from drugs and alcohol and suicide started to climb, first slowly and then very rapidly, at first that was being masked by the fact that we were making great progress against cardiovascular disease, better antihypertensives and people stopping smoking, and mortality was falling like a stone from cardiovascular disease. But that progress, for reasons that are not well understood, stopped. So that no longer masks the fact that people are killing themselves in these ways. And so that all-cause mortality has been rising, and starting in 2014, for the first time in a century, life expectancy fell for 3 years running. And now with COVID, we find that's the case again, that life expectancy continues to fall. There was good news for African Americans and Hispanics, who saw their life expectancy rise a bit between 20 and 21. But for whites, it continues to fall, partly due to resistance against the vaccine. So greater risk of dying of COVID.
Princeton University Emeritus Professor Anne Case has sparked conversations around the rising socioeconomic inequality in the U.S., what it's doing to our nation, coined the term deaths of despair. Have you or your loved one struggled with depression or substance abuse? What do you think should be done to address these growing epidemics? Are you worried about finding good-paying jobs and meaningful work without a college diploma? Has your family been broken apart in the pandemic? What can you share? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anne Case here on the Ideas Network. Public health experts are warning of this downward life expectancy trajectory in the U.S. We're looking closer at root causes of midlife deaths among white Americans and this political moment we're in. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Princeton University Emeritus Professor of Economics Ann Case has been investigating for years why middle-aged white people without college degrees are increasingly dying from suicide, from drug overdoses, alcohol abuse. Can you identify with this research? Are you a person of color? Do you think this research is ignoring experiences of people who are not white? What is on your mind about deaths in America? 800-642-1234. Ann Case with us for the hour. Let's bring in Jerry now in Pittsville. Jerry, hi, what are your thoughts?
I was carefully listening to what you guys have been saying, and I think that there's an aspect of white American men, I'll say it like that, that perhaps is being overlooked, and that is that CRT, or commonly called critical race theory, could potentially play a part in this idea of despair or death by despair. Because it seems as if the caricature of white American men here in the United States is that there's this element of racism in everybody. And a lot of the frustration and the anger is being directed at white American men. And there's really no discourse and there's no way to have a discussion about that. And I think that over the course, certainly, of the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen that play out time and again.
And let's let Anne jump in here. Anne, go ahead.
Sure. No, it's to talk about this fully, one has to talk about race. But I want to start by saying it's men and women who have seen this year-on-year increase in their deaths from drugs, alcohol, and suicide. That women have kept pace with men in this this horrible epidemic. I think that when we think about, like, well, why is this happening to the white working class? When we looked at this hard and read a lot and thought about it and talked to experts, what we thought was that what we're seeing among the white working class is what was seen among the Black working class in the late 1960s and the 1970s, that manufacturing jobs left the inner city. And when they left, marriage rates fell in the African-American community. Out of wedlock childbearing increased dramatically in the African-American community. And it was punctuated by a crack epidemic. Well, the wheel comes around again, this time for the white working class. And what we find is marriage rates have fallen dramatically, out of wedlock childbearing has increased dramatically, and it was punctuated by an opioid epidemic that hit whites much harder and faster than it hit Blacks. So we think that what had been being said about Black culture, and I'm using air quotes here, in the 60s and the 70s, is now being used by conservative economists to talk about white working class culture in the same way that these people are. They're not industrious, they've lost their moral compass. And we think for both groups, what happens is it's much easier, you know, to be virtuous if you have a good job. And we think it really comes down to jobs and the fact that for reasons that I hope we'll talk about in the hour, those jobs went away and they're not coming back.
And I wonder also, will the rising mortality among this group of white people that you have studied also help scientists understand health problems that are affecting other groups, that are affecting people of color?
Absolutely. And in fact, after we published a paper on what we had found back in 2015, and it caused quite a stir. It came out before the 2016 presidential election, and it showed that this was happening in the white community. And so the media was all over it. But we only had data then up through 2014. And at that point, mortality rates from drugs and alcohol in the Black community had been falling nicely for 20 years, and whites had higher rates of mortality from drugs and alcohol. However, with the arrival of fentanyl, that very, very powerful street drug that's taken over, unfortunately, that has come into the Black community as well. It can be mixed with cocaine, it can be mixed with heroin, it can be sold as, off-label OxyContin, and it's deadly. And what we've seen is a dramatic rise among Blacks without a BA, a dramatic rise in drug overdose as well. So we're much more interested in the fact that between races, there's been real convergence in mortality rates by education. So Blacks with a BA look a lot more like whites with a BA than they look like Blacks without. And whites without a BA look a lot more like Blacks without a BA than they look like whites with a BA, if I said that sort of quickly. But there's so we think that the problems eventually will be seen as more problems of class than of problems of race.
I'm going to just jump in here and reintroduce you. Ann Case, Emeritus Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton, has documented the rise in deaths of despair, particularly among working class white people. Let's bring in Jerry now in Viola. Jerry, hi. What would you like to bring up about the tax policy and the economics of this?
Good morning. Fascinating segment. I just want to know, is there a correlation between the tax policy? It seems like before Reagan, if you made over the equivalent of $5 million, you were taxed 90%. And it seems like titans of industry would say, I'm not going to pay 90% of my income to the government. I'm going to pay my employees more. I'm going to invest in factories. And after Reagan, these guys just got to keep all the money, and so wages started going down. And maybe there's the taxation is one reason why we're seeing, the suicide rate go up over the last 50 years. Just an
Jerry,
idea.
thank you. And what about this piece?
So, for sure, we need to drill into what's happened to wages and why. And for sure, there's been a change in social norms about what it's acceptable for the titans to keep, and the distance between their incomes and the incomes of the people who are working for them. But we think that the wages fell for three different reasons, at least. Globalization. So a lot of jobs leaving the country. People who were in the Department of Labor back when NAFTA was passed knew that jobs were going to be lost, but they had thought, well, this is a really good time for the US to upskill. Well, the jobs got lost and the upskilling didn't take place. There's also automation. But on top of that, and this is what really flies under the radar, is that a lot of jobs are being eliminated because our healthcare system is so expensive. That if I'm an employer and I have to pay my share, which is about 70% of a $21,000 a year premium for a family policy to keep a worker, I'm going to outsource that job. So somebody who used to work for a big hotel chain and might have thought that they were on a ladder up is now working for the Albright cleaning company where there's no ladder up, and where the benefits aren't good and where there's very little prospect for the future. And we think that too little attention is paid to the fact that $1.05 in the US is going up the income distribution to the healthcare industry, and that money is not available for wages, that money is not available for states that have to pay their share of Medicaid, that money is not available to fund the great state university systems. Hmm. And so we think that there are multiple reasons why jobs have disappeared, hmm. and that we need to think really hard about how we try to amend that.
Princeton University economist Ann Case, written extensively about health over her career, our guide to deaths of despair, what to make of declining life expectancy in America. Is there a way to cultivate an economy that benefits everyone? Does your viewpoint on these deaths correlate with your family experience? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Ann Case after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about midlife morbidity, mortality in America on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. hitting a grim milestone late last year when the CDC announced that more than 100,000 Americans had died from drug overdoses in a single year. These types of deaths, they're a piece of what Princeton economist Ann Case has studied for years, coining the term deaths of despair. Liver disease from alcohol, suicide, other contributors. Ann Case, Emeritus Professor of Economics and Public Affairs, with us for the hour. Let's bring in Mac now in Milwaukee. Hi, Mac. What would you like to bring up?
Hi. I just wanted to bring up, I have some experience with this, but maybe in a slightly different way. I just graduated like 2 years ago with a PhD in the humanities, and I was kind of on track to die a death of despair, I think, when I was doing that. I saw my job as meaningless. Like, I was working in this debt factory where I had no labor protections. There was all sorts of harassment. There's no future in the field. And I switched over to working in construction, and now I like see what I've done. I'm outside. I'm about to join a union, and I think when the difference between friends I have with a college degree who have meaningful careers and those who don't, you know, it's like really being in a union, having labor protections, like seeing some kind of meaning in your life. So I think that's somewhat of a breakdown for me, if that makes sense.
Mac, thank you so much for sharing your story. Ann Case, your thoughts?
Yeah, thank you very much. This just really highlights, I think people want to think they make a difference. People have something inside them that says, I want to think that what I do contributes. And when you think about contributive justice, that everyone deserves a chance to make a difference, that's, I think, essential to how we feel about being human beings. And so I think that not everyone should go to college or get a PhD, but that people who do not go to college should be given the skills that they need to really do something to make a difference. So we think that although it's a very heavy lift, we need to be thinking more constructively about how K through 12 education systems need to change in the 21st century so that people can go out into the labor force and take a job and be proud of the job that they're doing, which gives them esteem, which helps them to thrive. And that is just really important.
I want to pick up on the piece of Mac joining a union in their labor area. How much does the demise of unions relate to the increased deaths?
I think that's really important. It's very hard to quantify, but unions did many things. Unions gave labor a voice in Washington, which is now absent. So there is not a balance between labor and capital because the unions are gone. It's also the case that unions protected workplaces. And we saw during COVID a number of times where workers would appeal to the public because they said, my workplace is not protecting me against COVID and I must come to work. And the other really important part is that unions used to play a really important part in people's social lives. Mm-hmm. There were union halls. People were a part of a community. Those communities are now gone. Those union halls are now closed. And that leads to more isolation, less community engagement. And that also is a contributing factor to people questioning the way that they're living and whether or not they use substances to feed the beast, to soothe the beast.
I want to pick up also on education, that, you know, what a bachelor's degree is, what it affords, and there has to be an alternative, right? There's got to be a path to a socially recognized work other than through a diploma on the wall. How do you change that? How do you change that societal image in America?
So, great question. And I think there are two things here. One is about the societal image. And part of it is just that I think whether or not we are giving people skill sets. Mm-hmm. In New Jersey, for example, there are many high schools that now partner with industry so that high school students can work part-time and finish high school, but they're finishing high school focusing on the subjects that will help them in the jobs that they're doing out in, in the country. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a positive step forward. If we look to other rich countries, which are not seeing these deaths of despair rise, in fact, suicide around the world has been falling since 2000, while it's been rising in the US, we see apprenticeships and the kinds of programs where people join a working group, they're an apprentice, they have skills, and that gives them esteem. Now, there's also the image part, though, to come back to that.
Mm-hmm.
We need to value everyone, right? I think this is something that can't be quantified, but I think that we tend to value people more when they're better paid. So when my plumber comes or my electrician comes and they have skill sets that I do not have and I pay them incredibly well, I value them enormously. And I think that higher pay for people will also cause us to change the way in which we see people.
Jeremy in Racine wanted to add and called in, couldn't stay, in that we live in a materialistic society, Jeremy says, with unrealistic expectations. And how much of that is contributing to people's overall idea of success, an overall idea of happiness or lack thereof?
I was just reading an article that the Finns are apparently the quote unquote happiest people in the world. And in part, when asked about this, they say that, well, we don't need a lot of things. We're just really happy with the lives that we lead. Where I think actually there's more esteem shown to people in all walks of life.
Hmm.
I think that there are people who have written after our first paper on the fact that whites in America without a BA see that they will not live as well as their parents lived.
Hmm.
And they hypothesize that that's part of what's happening here, that people became accustomed to each generation doing better than the previous generation. And if by age 40, I don't have the things that my parents had, then I consider myself a failure. And so it's possible that that bleeds into this as well.
Ann Case, Emeritus Professor of Economics, Public Affairs at Princeton, co-author of Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. And we're going to focus here and look more on policies in the future, looking more to solutions to how to turn this tide. And along those lines, let's go to Jack in Milwaukee. Jack, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'm a bit concerned about the issue of political accountability. Recently, I read a book from an East Coast University author named Tooze, T-O-O-Z-E, called The Crash. And his study was basically from the time of Clinton and the loss of the Glass-Steagall Act all the way through to the almost to this current period, in which he also made some very interesting commentary about the problems in Russia right now. What seems to me is that we don't have the civics awareness we once had functionally in government. And the problem that I see is although government tries to react to problems as best as they can, usually late and in a cobbled together way, it seems focused on whatever they do to make sure that incumbency is preserved. What they do is they do things that sort of kick issues down the road, and you end up with a frustrated public because of the consequences, but there is absolutely no accountability against the individual representative or senator or president. Recently, for example...
I want Ann to jump in here, Jack. Ann, go ahead.
Those are all great observations. I mean, part of the lack of accountability goes hand in hand with the fact that the lobbyists in Washington right now are really out of control. I was speaking earlier about the expensive healthcare system we have in the US. We now have 5 healthcare lobbyists for every member of Congress, 5. That's just stunning. They are at the table when the decisions are made. And so, and also given the way we finance our elections right now, legislators need to find people with deep pockets who are going to fund their campaigns. And so of course, there are going to be problems where, who am I really listening to, the people or the people who are funding me? But going back to Crash, and going back to the financial crisis of 2008, I think a lot of people in America lost faith in their government then because they were losing their homes, they were losing their jobs, and the people who caused this to happen got extra bonuses. No one went to jail. And I think that when we think about distrust of government, that people thought that we were all in this together, and then suddenly it became really obvious that we weren't all in this together. And so I think that when we think about people not trusting the government and what they say about how to protect yourself against COVID, well, they have really good reason not to trust the government, because the government has not always shown itself to be working in their best interests.
Princeton University Emeritus Professor of Economics Ann Case with us studying Deaths of Despair. We'll pick this up back in a minute with Ann Case here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Emeritus Economics Professor at Princeton, Ann Case, researches the great socioeconomic divide in America and how it's a culprit in the mortality rates of white Americans, in particular, without a college degree. And her 2020 book on this was called Deaths of Despair, The Future of Capitalism. She's with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring on Gary now in Ripon. Gary, hi.
Yes, good morning. If it's true that these jobs are not coming back, then do we have to basically accept that this is the way things are going to be forever?
Gary, thank you. And yeah, go ahead.
Gary, thank you for that. No, we don't have to think that this is the way things will be going forward, because it's not sustainable. I think actually that it's possible that something might have to break very badly before, for example, Congress is actually more accountable to us. I think things might have to break very badly before there can be real change in the way we finance healthcare and in K through 12 education.
And when you say break very badly, what might that entail? What does that look like?
I'm not sure what that looks like. I had hoped in my Pollyanna kind of way that with COVID, with so many people having to present at hospitals that were going to charge them more than they could afford, that healthcare reform would move from the far left up into the middle of the distribution, and that more people would start to talk about the fact that this cannot go on the way it is, that we are going to have to make change. Unfortunately, that does not appear to have happened. And people are going to be presented with medical bills that they can't pay. And I'm not sure what happens to them. But I think that politically, the divide that we find between the Democrats, who really have become a party of the cosmopolitan educated elite, and the Republican Party, which has taken under its wing the white working class, are going to be battling it out now for a while. I don't know what it's going to look like. I can give you some positive things. I think if we do change the education system so that people at age 18 who do not choose to go to college can be given the skills that they need and a connection to the labor force that will pay them well enough to live a middle-class life, I think that will help. And I also think we will pull back on globalization, and that will help. I think that the people who signed NAFTA, the people who brought us China's entry into the World Trade Organization, who really didn't give one whit to what that would mean to jobs in the U.S., well, they're being bumped off the golden chair now, and that we will be offering more protections. That is a guess. And I'm hoping that might happen, because I think that as a society, we need to find a place where people who work hard can live well and live with self-esteem.
Let's bring on Aaron in Madison with thoughts. Aaron, hi. What would you like to share?
Hi. I just kind of wanted to tag back on the idea of having esteem doing maybe an uneducated, quote unquote, job. And I think a lot of that as a millennial comes from the older generation kind of worrying or being judgmental about, you know, how we are doing if we don't have a bachelor's degree in our work, and that our generation maybe isn't as successful as theirs was, or like more mobile. But like as a millennial, I've tried, you know, I have an associate's degree, but I found like a more meaningful life just doing a, you know, like a farm job. And like, I find it hard to get respect from my peers for that, and also just have kind of worry from my family that that's not good enough. But like, I would feel great about it if they just didn't worry or judge it.
Aaron, so interesting. And what do you make of that judgment?
I think that, for example, Michael Sandel, who's a philosopher at Harvard, has written a great book called The Tyranny of Merit. And he talks about this as the BA is really necessary for in the U.S. today for self-esteem, and that there have been times in our history when that wasn't the case, although the tension has always been there. And that I think that if we could, it's going to need people to change the lenses that they use when they're thinking about get ahead, get ahead, get ahead. I don't have the answers to that, but I think that's very important. Community engagement. Community is really important in protecting people against suicide. And the loss of community is incredibly risky. So I think if a lot of things that are going to have to happen are going to have to happen locally, and that it has to be a local engagement with farmers markets. It's going to have to be a local engagement with bringing people together to help this community to thrive. Top down is going to be important to stop monopolies from taking over, but bottom up is essential if we're going to make a difference.
And I'm thinking about the loss of community in COVID, all of the events that couldn't take place for so long, and still the apprehension of being even nearby someone else with, you know, mask or maskless. That too, I would imagine, has repercussions on this.
Absolutely. Ironically, somewhat, suicides dropped between 2019 and 2020, not much, but a little bit. And we were agnostic about what would happen to suicides during lockdowns, because the beginning of COVID, you might think of as being almost like we were in a war against this virus. And in war times, suicides fall. But at the same time, both death from alcohol and death from drugs spiked during 2020. And part of that, I think, is because isolation brought on people's worst spirits that they can sometimes find lift if they can go out, they bump into someone, they share a hello. The little things make a huge difference, and COVID stopped that from happening.
Anne, thank you for sharing your research with us. Thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, and I just wanted to say I will be giving a public lecture in Madison.
And it is tomorrow, and I'm going to jump in here tomorrow night at the Overture Center in Madison as part of a talk for UW-Madison. We have a link to it, information on our website at wpr.org/mornings. And if you or a loved one has suicidal thoughts, there's someone to talk to. You can reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's 800-273-8255, 800-273-TALK. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.